on shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is Media Network Plus.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome again to another edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. This, of course, is the month of December, so for the remainder of the month, we're going to be bringing you a series of best of programs. Over the next 3 weeks, we're going to be bringing to you an interview that we did with Andy Sennett a few years ago now that many of you have actually wanted to hear again. So we're going to be bringing you that today. Now, Andy Sennett is one of these radio people who didn't work so much on the programming side as a presenter, even though he did some of that. He did spend a number of years with BBC Monitoring in the United Kingdom, as well as one of the editors of the World Radio TV Handbook. A book, of course, that anybody who was a shortwave listener probably had a copy of. But we need to go back a little bit further, and what sparked this interest in radio? Was it, for example, like myself, of, well, just finding an old radio around the house and kind of tuning in to stations from overseas? Was it like that, or was it something else?
My grandfather had given my parents a radio for their wedding, and when they got married, and this radio was supposed to receive long and medium wave, but due to a faulty wave chain switch, it could only receive long wave. And my mother was quite happy with that, because in those days, BBC, the old light program was on long wave, so she listened to that all day. But I discovered there was another thing on long wave, and that was the Voice of America relay station in Munich. And I found that, and I found it very interesting, because, you know, American voices. And of course, initially, I didn't know it. Well, you know, I thought I'd picked up America. And so that got me really interested. And indeed, I was around that sort of age, 9 or 10 years old, I guess.
So you discovered it from longwave listening. How did that go into shortwave? Or was that just the obvious next step and you decided to get a better radio? And you're like, oh, what does this do? And you have all the countries, you know, Germany, Finland, Sweden, Australia.
Yes, exactly. I, you know, got realized from listening to the VOA that they had other transmissions which I couldn't pick up. And I'd also, the other thing is, my grandfather had been very keen on radio himself, and it was actually, you know, repaired radios for people. And I remember the first radio station I ever heard on shortwave in his shed in the bottom of the garden was Radio Canada International. So I knew there were all these things out there. So I, you know, kept persuading my father I wanted a radio that could pick up shortwave. So I think we bought an old mains radio from somewhere, and that's how I got started.
So it actually seems like I'm actually on the right track, because everybody that I've asked that question to have exactly the same story. I mean, it's so different from, let's say, you know, people that just say discover television or film or other mediums. I mean, with international broadcasting, that seems to be the way people did it.
Yeah, I mean, I think most people discovered international broadcasting by accident. I mean, obviously later I went to work for the World Radio TV Handbook, but I'd never heard of it then. And, you know, I had no idea how to find information about broadcasters. I hadn't heard of DXing or DX clubs or anything like that. So, you know, it was a learning curve, and learning by listening.
Now, back then, when you got your first receiver and you started to listen, what sort of things would you listen to? I mean, you just said that one of the first stations you heard was Radio Canada International, or as it was called then, the CBC International Service. What were some of the other ones you remember?
Well, even on medium wave, there were quite a few in those days. There was Radio Berlin International from East Germany. There was Radio Prague. And Radio Budapest in Hungary also had a medium wave transmission on Friday night, I think it was, a live transmission in English. And, you know, I gradually got to know those stations and then heard details of their shortwave programs via the medium wave. So then I tried to find them on shortwave. Of course, it wasn't easy, because these old sets didn't have exact frequency readout. You know, I had to just twiddle the dial a few times until I found them.
You know what's interesting, Andy, and, you know, for the years that I've been listening, there are two major events that stick out in my memory that I learned
from listening to international shortwave broadcasting. One of them was the release of Nelson Mandela on Radio RSA, the voice of South Africa. And the second one would be June 4th, 1989, with what happened in Tiananmen Square. And I tell people, younger people that is, you know, I heard this from the radio because the internet was, well, practically non-existent. CNN was around at the time, but their international news coverage, well, was very slim. It was mainly focused on the United States. I mean, this was the main way to get international news, to get it quick, because newspapers, if something happened, let's say, in Beijing on a Thursday, it wouldn't be reported in a newspaper until a Friday night or Saturday in North America.
No, I had the same experience. I mean, I remember when President Kennedy was assassinated, my mother came into my bedroom. I was 13 at the time, and my first instinct was, oh, I better tune to the Voice of America. And I actually heard the Voice of America announce that President Lyndon B. Johnson is the new president of the United States. And then a few minutes later, they had to retract it, saying, oh, we understand the reports that President Kennedy had died were premature and have not been confirmed. So they actually announced, I mean, he had actually died by then, but they announced it too early. And I don't think they would make that mistake these days because there are a lot more ways of finding things out. And the other big event that I remember from my early listening was in 1968 when the Russians went into Czechoslovakia. And I remember listening to the two Radio Prague's, the Radio Prague that was taken over by the Russians and Radio Free Prague, which was broadcasting, I understand, from, I think it was from Bratislava. And they were still broadcasting, programs talking about the Prague Spring, which, of course, very quickly, within a few days, came to an end.
It is quite interesting, you know, when you think back that at the time, getting news this immediate, this quick was a rarity. I mean, Danny, even television couldn't report on a lot of these news stories as quick as radio did.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, I did have a personal experience of that. I went to work at BBC Monitoring after I finished at university. And during my time there, I was just coming to the end of night shift, and I noticed that the Voice of Nigeria hadn't broadcast the news. And I told my colleague who was coming to take over for the day shift, please make sure you record the next news bulletin because the last one didn't air. And I figured, you know, I had a hunch that something was going on, and at 1 minute past the hour, I suddenly heard him call coup in Nigeria. And in fact, the Voice of Nigeria was the first source of information to the outside world that there had been a coup there. The airport was closed, everything was closed, and the first announcement was on the Voice of Nigeria's shortwave service.
A story that Vasily Strelnikov told me once that when I talked to him recently, we talked about it again because it was so funny. When he started at Radio Moscow, one of his jobs was reading continuity and reading news bulletins on the hour and half hour. And he said back in those days, the news on the hour had to be exactly so many minutes right down to the last second. Oh, sorry. And he said what would happen is because certain presenters would read faster or slower than others. If you read faster, you would take the first story from a news bulletin from 2 hours ago and reread that one. And he told me about this one time. He was on news shift on a Saturday, and he was a fast reader, so he kept reading the same story over and over and over, and it was about a literary conference that was taking place in Moscow. And he told me later he found out that BBC Monitoring had been listening to this same story over and over and over and actually notified the Foreign Office in the UK thinking that it was some type of code.
that did actually used to happen. We had to report, they call it a station behavior at BBC Monitoring, and they still do that. Anything unusual is you know, monitored very carefully because, you know, it could be indicative of something going on. Another thing they do is that they listen. They used to listen during the Cold War to all the reports of official meetings and ceremonies and so on, and note carefully the order in which names of different officials were read out. And if somebody went up the list, you know, they were doing well. Somebody went down the list, you know, they were probably heading for the Far East or something. So you know, in those days, a lot of information was passed to the Foreign Office from monitoring ordinary public radio broadcasts.
Now, the time that you were at BBC monitoring, how did it work? Did you have they say, here's a couple of radios, here's some headphones, here's some tape machines, go to work?
Well, I was actually an operational assistant, and that my job was to make sure that the monitors in the different languages received the right station at the right time and the right place, because we had well, if you can imagine a big board with jack sockets and jack cords and plugs and so on, and we had to make sure that stuff which we had a receiving station several miles away with, you know, special antennas and very good receivers and so on, and that the more difficult stations were picked up there and then fed to us online, and then we had to make sure that what we received was passed on to the monitor in the correct place, so he was listening to the right thing. And in addition to live programs, we also record, you know, some of them which were less considered less important, were recorded and listened to later.
Now, when you worked at BBC monitoring, let's say programs that went out live or the ones that were recorded, what would happen after to the tapes? Would they just be archived or would they be erased and used for something else?
I'm not absolutely sure, but I think there was a procedure by which somebody would decide what should be kept and what can be archived. Each broadcast had a different level of importance, so it might be the very important broadcasters would be texted in full, so the entire text would be produced. Some broadcasts would be summarized, and that required obviously some editorial, some knowledge of the country concerned, and others maybe just they would simply write the headlines of news items, and then if somebody yes they would. Certainly, the audio will be kept for a certain time. So if anybody in London requested further details of a particular item, this could be done for them.
How long did you stay with BBC Monitoring?
Just 4 years.
And your next step after that, was that with the World Radio TV Handbook?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I had envisaged staying a lot longer than I did, but simply somebody said that there was an advertisement in Shortwave Magazine, which was mainly for radio amateurs in the UK, from Jens Frost, who was the editor of the WRTH, and he was looking for an assistant. And just a few months earlier, a colleague of mine, who was only a few years older than me, had been promoted to chief monitor in my section, so I knew that my chances of promotion you know, it's going to take a long time before I could be promoted to a more senior position. So I decided to have a go at the WRTH job. And I gather that because it was in a relatively obscure place, most broadcast listeners didn't see it. You know, I was the only person who applied.
I mean, up until that point, did you also consider, say, working as a broadcaster, or had you also worked as a broadcaster during that time?
No, well, as you can hear, Keith, I don't have a good radio voice. My diction is not perfect. I mean, these things can be coached. But I, you know, prefer to be working behind the scenes. No, my broadcasting career, such as it was, came a little later when I joined Radio Netherlands as a freelance.
How long you were with the World Radio TV Handbook?
19 years altogether. I was I went to Denmark in 1978. Jens Frost retired in 1987. And then I moved to take over as editor-in-chief in Amsterdam in 1987 and had another 10 editions under my control.
Now, from that point, when you were at the World Radio TV Handbook, to when you started listening for the very first time to Radio Canada International, what were some of the major changes that took place during that time in international broadcasting. I'm not talking about, let's say, changes politically in many countries around the world, but let's say from a listening standpoint, or had shortwave from when you started listening to the World Radio TV Handbook, had it just been the same?
Yeah, I mean, I think the crucial point was the end of the Cold War. Up until then, a lot of broadcasters, you know, year by year, you've got the same programs at the same times every week, with the same presenters, and often, you know, mailbag programs with letters from the same listeners, and they basically just carried on because the Cold War was on, and nobody saw fit to to get out of international broadcasting. Once this had happened, and Germany had been reunified, and the Soviet states had become independent. The whole reason for a lot of these stations being on the air was started being called into question by politicians. You know, do we really need to broadcast in so many languages and so on? And so with that, the kind of programming of the languages that they decided to keep also changed, and in many cases became a lot more informal, but possibly from a politician's point of view, a lot less relevant to what they thought politicians should be approving.
You know, because we've seen, like, you know, since the Cold War ended, a lot of stations, and I would put them in the category of these small to medium sized broadcasters, stations like YOE Radio Finland, Radio Norway, Radio Denmark, and a number of other ones, just sort of vanish into thin air. It seems that the larger and more powerful ones are around today. But international broadcasting, Andy, around that time, what was the mood in it? Because, you know, when I speak to some people like Bob Zanotti or Ian McFarland, they all tell me that at that time, people were starting to say, what do we do now?
Yeah, exactly. When I joined the WRTH, I started going around to visit various broadcasters, and I found the morale was generally quite low, and quite a lot of people had been there since, you know, for 20, 30 years, and they were sort of just looking to see how many more years they had to work until they could retire. And there wasn't a great deal of motivation to come up with new ideas and produce better programs. The only motivation was to convince the people who funded them that they should continue to be funded, and, you know, until it was time for them to retire.
Do you think, let's say, international broadcasting as it is today, or as it was then, would have fared better over the last, say, 20, 25 years, if after the Cold War, broadcasters said, okay, look, things have changed, we have to change with the times and do something different to keep an audience? Because from what I've seen, a lot of people just sat around for many years, and then when government said, oh, we're going to cut you, they went, huh, why?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is, as I said, a lot of people had been in the business for so long, and when you're in just one business and you're not taking a wider perspective, you kind of get into a rut, and you don't really realize how the world around you has changed. And I think a lot of the things that the stations were putting out, although they just kept regurgitating the same, you know, kind of format and the same content, it was becoming less and less relevant to the people who, you know, were, they hoped would tune in, and particularly young people. And it was mainly the audiences for international broadcasting in the last 20 years. The average age has got older and older. And you know, if you look at some of the forums now for people who discuss international broadcasting, it's like an edition of the British sitcom Grumpy Old Men.
But, you know, it really is, Andy, you know, depending on region. I mean, if I take East Asia and Southeast Asia and the Pacific, the listeners tend to be a lot younger than, let's say, listeners in North America or in Europe.
Yeah, I think that's right, because I was mainly referring to Europe and North America, where, you know, the shortwave audience has shrunk to a very, very low amount compared with what it was 10 years ago. But certainly in parts of Asia and in Africa, you know, shortwave in many countries is still very important. And I think the problem that some broadcasters have had is that they haven't done enough research. I was, in the last few years, involved in a strategy at Radio Netherlands where we actually looked at the situation in each country And what we found was that the situation, for example, in Africa, countries may be neighboring countries, but they had totally different media landscape. You know, for example, in Nigeria, just about everybody has a mobile phone, whereas there are still some African countries where mobile phones are by no means ubiquitous. And so you have to employ different strategies to reach people in those different environments.
But yet, Andy, you know, some international broadcasters during that transition period fared very well. I mean, for example, Radio Netherlands, after 1992, 1993, started to make major changes in the way they did programs and their presentation and everything, and remained relevant. But some other broadcasters, I can think of one right now, Deutsche Welle, didn't change at all and really didn't start to change until a few years ago.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I can't speak for other broadcasters, but certainly at Radio Netherlands, I guess we were unusual in that we had some very highly motivated people on the staff. And, you know, they were very careful about who they hired, and they would make sure that somebody was really, really genuinely interested in, you know, they weren't just going there to find a cushy job. And the result was that, you know, we would constantly discuss amongst ourselves whether we were doing the right thing, how things were going, whether we should be doing something different. And there was always plenty of new ideas coming along. And I'm not sure that was the case at all the other broadcasters. But as I say, I'm not really in a position, since I haven't worked there, to comment on that.
After you left World Radio TV Handbook, was this the time, or did you take some time off before you went to Radio Netherlands?
Well, I probably would have done. I mean, I actually, Bart Kapiras, my associate editor, and I both decided to leave at the same time. I won't go into the details why, but we had problems with the publisher. I expected to be probably unemployed for quite a few months before finding some other employment. But because I had been freelancing since 1981 with media news from the WRTH on Media Network, I knew Deanna Jansen very well, who was obviously the co-host of the program at the time. And within a few weeks, I got a call from her saying, you know, we need somebody to come and work for our new internet department. Would you like to come along and we'll talk about it? So I got, if you like, headhunted. I jokingly say headhunted, but of course, I wasn't really doing anything. They didn't have to do much hunting to find me.
So it was. It sounds like it was almost just by accident. You just happened to be at the right place at the right time, and everything was like a perfect storm.
Yes, precisely. And not only that, but because I had been going to Radio Netherlands since I moved to Amsterdam in 1987, and, you know, I'd been going up to do my monthly contribution in Hilversum. So I got to meet some of the other presenters, people like Pete Myers, who was fondly remembered by everybody who worked with him, so I felt I was going to join friends. So it wasn't really like starting a new job. It was just like, going back home almost.
How many years did you spend at Radio Netherlands?
Well, or believe it or not, the unlucky 13, I guess. It's actually 15 if you count, because I started as a freelance, then I got a part-time contract. My full-time contract started 1st of January 1999. So indeed, that's just a little over 13 years.
You haven't worked for Radio Netherlands. You took early retirement because of a massive budget cut that affected the station. The time that you've had off, I mean, did you say to yourself, you know, I would have liked to have stayed on for another few years?
Well, I think possibly, I mean, the way my mind had been working, I wanted to have a bit of a break because I was doing this Media Network weblog, and it was basically 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. I got very little time off. I think I only had two Christmas holidays in that time. I did take time away from the office because I had to, you know, because of the terms of the contract and so on. But, I simply sat at home and worked in my home office. So I was actually producing the same amount of material for the public as I was, you know, when I was in the office in Hilversum. So I really needed a break. But I think I probably would have decided to go part-time had the job still been there.
Now, the Media Network blog, how did that come about?
Well, we started producing material on the website. You know, once the website got established in the mid-1990s, and once the Media Network radio show ended, Jonathan Marx said to me, "Well, there's no reason at all to end the web version, because you know, that's something which hopefully will develop over the years." So I carried on doing web stories and web features, but the reason for the blog was simply in 1993, when the Allies went into Iraq. There was a lot of breaking media news, and at that time, the only way to update it was to go into the office and update it in Hilversum. And I wanted a way to be able to update things from home. So if I heard some interesting media news, I didn't have to take an hour's journey into the office just to type, you know, 5 minutes worth of news online. So it was really a matter of finding a solution to a particular problem. But what happened was that when the media news from Iraq died down after Saddam was captured, and there was plenty of military news and political news, but less media news. So we decided to expand the media blog to cover media items from the whole world. So that's really when how it started. Again, by chance.
And that was part one of my conversation from some time ago with Andy Sennett, who is now retired from Radio Netherlands, but spent some time there. And next week on the program, we will bring you part two of that conversation. Now, we are during the holiday season, and it's usually at this point I say now time to go to our propagation editor, Glenn Hauser. But this week and next week, Glenn Hauser will not be presenting propagation because these two programs have been recorded well in advance. But don't worry, Glenn will be returning very, very soon for those who want to hear the propagation forecast. But you can also listen to it on his own program, World of Radio. Now, if you want to get in touch with us to let us know what you think of the program, or just say, how do you do? Like that, how do you do? Our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. So, on behalf of everyone here at PCJ Radio International and the complete Media Network Plus team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. 73 and 88 to the ladies.